Hey, thanks for having me.
When I hear homeland security, I have to admit, I think terrorist. Is that what people think when they hear where you work?
They do initially. In fact, our center is a little different than some of the other centers that DHS funds. In many ways, our center evolved from Hurricane Katrina. And so there are other centers that focus on terrorism. Many of them were created after 9/11, but ours is very much focused on coastal hazards resilience.
What is your role?
So I'm the director of the center. It's comprised of approximately 28 universities. We do research on land use planning, engineering, social sciences. We also have an educational component where we develop curricula, degree programs focused on natural hazards resilience, and I lead those overall efforts.
What does resilience mean in the context of your work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in many ways, we think of resilience as rebounding to some extreme event, some shock to a system. An important distinction, I think, and as the term resilience is evolving, it's rebounding to something perhaps different. And by that, I mean it's not necessarily returning to what we once knew, if that in fact was extremely vulnerable, or it might have been inequitable. It might have been exemplified by a degraded environment, but rather resilience in theory is re responding or rebounding from a shock to that system in a way that takes into account, for example, the idea of incorporating risk reduction into that recovery process, trying to reconstitute social networks that might have been damaged, repairing disrupted economies, again, trying to return to some new sense of normalcy that was better than what you may have had before.
You looked at two hurricanes, Floyd in North Carolina in 99, and the more well-known to us, at least here in Australia, Katrina in Mississippi in 2005. What was the impact of those hurricanes?
So those two storms were the worst disasters in those respective states' histories. And so in the case of North Carolina, Hurricane Floyd, we had an area the size of the state of Maryland underwater. Approximately 55,000 homes flooded. So again, while it was a hurricane, it was a major rain event. And that was a little bit unique, a little surprising to us. You know, we often associate hurricanes or cyclones with heavy wind damage. It really wasn't the wind, but it was the amount of rainfall. We had approximately 30 inches of rain in about a 10-hour period on an area that had already experienced another hurricane. So the ground was saturated, and then there was another storm. And so that was the worst disaster in the state's history in North Carolina. In the case of Mississippi, Hurricane Katrina, which outside of the U.S., in fact, even inside the U.S., we often think of as an event that we think of it and we equate it to New Orleans. And there's no doubt it was catastrophic loss there. But in the case of Mississippi, there were 50,000 homes that were destroyed, simply washed away down to their foundations. A storm surge that equated to almost 30 feet in height. So the idea of 50,000 homes being lost overnight is still a major disaster.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you're completely right. I completely think New Orleans, and we don't really take into account. Why do you think that is, that the world's attention stays in one place?
Yeah, that's a good question. In fact, that was one of my job in working in the state of Mississippi was trying to tell our story, to say that there was catastrophic loss in Mississippi. I think in part, you know, the imagery of people being rescued from rooftops and the idea that the water stayed in New Orleans and there was a lot of media attention on that rising water and people needing to be rescued, whereas in Mississippi it was a very different scene. It was something akin to a tsunami, really, in that not necessarily the hazard itself, but just the level of damage, the type of damage, and so it was absolute destruction. And you know, whether that provided us, you know, the media coverage tended to focus on New Orleans in part. I think it was because of the large scale rescue required there.
You worked for both governors of those states, and have looked at their role and that of state agencies in disaster recovery. What sort of things did you look at?
So, you know, I've had the good fortune of working for two governors in the two worst disasters, as I mentioned, in those respective states' histories. And, you know, what I thought was interesting, among other things, is that they had very different political views in the states. You know, Governor Hunt, a very, what we consider a very progressive Democrat. In the case of Mississippi, Governor Barbour, a Republican, very conservative. But they both exhibited, at least to me, very strong leadership skills. They were out in front of the event. They were not only provided very strong political leadership, and they understood how to navigate the political process, of which disasters are inherently political, the unfortunate reality as they are.
How do you mean?
In the sense that the ability to gain access to post-disaster aid, or the ability to influence policy and perhaps change policy after disaster, those policies that may not reflect the needs and conditions of that jurisdiction. Both governors were very adept at that because they had a long-standing history of working within state and local decision-making venues such as Congress and or our legislature. In the case of North Carolina, Governor Hunt was able to procure $836 million of state legislative money that meant taking it out of our, somewhat ironically titled, the state's rainy day fund. That was meant to be used for a downturn in our economy, but rather he was able to draw that out, work with the legislature to create state programs that address gaps in federal aid post-disaster.
Floyd and Katrina are 6 years apart. Were any of the things that were learned in the recovery from Floyd employed during Katrina?
There were. One of the things that happened after Hurricane Floyd, which struck in 1999, there was the creation of what's called the Disaster Mitigation Act of 2000. In fact, it was created after Hurricane Floyd. And that required states and local governments to develop pre-disaster hazard mitigation plans. In essence, those plans are required to you assess your risk and vulnerability. And based on that knowledge, you develop policies or projects to reduce that risk. That could involve elevating homes out of the floodplain, moving them to higher ground, could be retrofitting schools for high wind. And so as a result of that, the communities in Mississippi and other states had those plans in place, which did help to some extent in terms of injecting risk reduction into the recovery process.
Do you think that there is enough planning for post-disaster recovery?
Absolutely not. That's one of the challenges. So we've got a mandate states and local governments are required to do hazard mitigation plans, but they're not required to do pre-disaster recovery plans. So in the U.S., one of our grand challenges is in a big event, there's large amounts of money that come into the state and then in turn into the local government. And if you haven't planned for that eventuality, you can be absolutely overwhelmed with the resources that are intended to help you. And if you haven't thought through how to not only work with government entities, but also with the private sector, quasi-governmental groups, even groups that emerge after disaster, and to coordinate the distribution of that aid and to coordinate the actions that all of those groups take in the aftermath in a thoughtful way, you often lead to suboptimal recovery outcomes.
You noticed, you noted in your speech a tendency in the U.S. to put the money into the aftermath rather than mitigating the damage in the first place. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, we do invest some money on the front end in hazard mitigation, but certainly not enough. I think the challenge, one of the great challenges in the U.S. and anywhere, is the issue that we would often refer to as issue salience, the idea that are we going to invest money today for something that may or may not happen in my given jurisdiction when we have competing issues such as we need new schools, we need to rebuild our infrastructure, our economy may have hit a bump in the road, so to speak. And so to have proactive leadership that incentivizes that proactive behavior in advance of something that may or may not happen, I think, to be honest with you, is one of the great challenges in the profession.
It resonates for us here in Queensland because we're a large state and we're prone to all manner of different disasters. You know, we've had fire, we've had cyclone, we've had, you know, rain events and many different ways of, and drought, many different ways that Mother Nature can turn on us. Do you see any resonance with Australia when you look at the way that we handle our disasters?
I do. And in fact, this is one of the reasons that I'm here, is that working with the Bushfire CRC, trying to develop a partnership between our center and theirs, and even thinking about how we might develop some type of international exchange program so that we could look at and learn from, for example, how you deal with bushfire and are there lessons there that could be applied for us as we deal with hurricanes or flooding, and vice versa. And so the idea of perhaps even developing something akin to a learning laboratory that we might have not only researchers, but practitioners and students sharing those lessons and perhaps even developing an exchange program of students so that the next generation can draw lessons internationally and apply them. And that's, to be honest with you, that's one of the issues that I'm interested in exploring, is that in the U.S. we don't do a very good job of drawing lessons from other nations, and we could do better.
My name's Kat Davidson. Professor Gavin Smith is my guest. He's from the Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence in the United States, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security. I feel like here in Australia, particularly in Queensland, we're seeing more disaster and closer together. Is that because of the nature of my work, or do you think that there's something else involved there?
Yeah. So one thing I think we need to be very careful about is to draw a direct correlation between a particular event and saying it's due to climate change. That's just the science. That's not where we are. However, if you look at the trends over time, there is a close association, and the science does show us that we are entering an era of climate change. It's happening. It's here. It's manifest in certain areas. We're seeing it in the context of more intense storms, more intense rainfall. It could be longer periods of drought, more intense heat. And one of the big issues we all, I think, need to think about is, so that's happening, and there's no doubt it's happening. But we also need to recognize it's happening to human settlements that were designed to reflect the climate of the past. And so if you think about that a little bit and step back, for example, in the case of Chicago in the U.S., we had a heat wave that killed 600 people, and almost all of those deaths were preventable. And those were multi-story walk-ups, people that were poor and didn't have air conditioning. But these were units that at one time, that was the norm. But as we reach greater temperatures, as sea levels rise, we have intensive development on the coast in the U.S. and certainly here in Australia. We've got to think about and we've got to confront these issues and think about seriously how we adapt and what is going to be politically feasible. Who's going to pay for it? How does the issue surrounding equity, how is that going to be accounted for? Or even people that, for example, might be water-dependent users, if you will, those that the ports and or the fishers and those that in the tourist industry that depend on the very thing that we think is beautiful, the water, which could very well be a significant threat.
How do you figure out then with climate change on in consideration, you can't know when a natural disaster is going to hit necessarily. So what kind of things do you consider when you think about mitigation and where the money should go and who should pay for it?
Right. So there are, and in fact, people in the field, in the profession, and many of them that are at the conference this week, have been engaged in the development of risk assessments, assessing risk and understanding that we can, and we have models and we have tools and techniques and even conveying the information to multiple audiences. We can convey risk, we can map it, we can analyze it, and we have a pretty good understanding of that risk. And it's a matter of conveying what we know and conveying it in a way that resonates with different audiences so that that in turn can also affect action, can affect change, can affect improved adaptation measures, and also, in a general sense, improved ways and collaborative ways to reduce risk.
How closely have you looked at the cyclone activity and the past events here in Australia?
Yeah, that's something that I'm not as familiar with, but I'm really keen on learning more because obviously the cyclone-hurricane connection, if you will, I mean, they're very similar in the context of effect. And so that's one example of something that we might explore between the U.S. and Australia.
Does much of the, and I guess this is slightly off topic, but I've always wondered this, does much of what happens here in Australia make it into the American media? I mean, we were, I guess it's a little macabre, but we watched very carefully Floyd, Katrina, 9/11, and we feel very affected by that. Does what happens here in Australia, is it reflected in America?
Well, certainly the bushfires, that was something that was something personally that I paid attention to in part because that's my professional area of interest. But there was quite a bit of coverage on that. I would suggest that maybe there's not enough in the sense that, and it kind of goes back to this issue that I'm really interested in doing more of, is trying to learn and draw more on those disasters that happen overseas. I think we can do better in the U.S. and trying to understand these major events here and in other nations as to, what are those lessons that we can draw and apply in our own country.
It's a very senior role you hold, so obviously it's taken quite some time to work to your level. What drives you? Why are you so passionate about this?
I think you'll find if you talk to people in the field, almost without exception, I think people are, for whatever reason, whether they kind of fell into the job or whether they pursued this as a career path, I think you'll find that most people are highly motivated. I think many people in the field recognize that you're often helping people at the lowest point in their life. Or on the flip side is you might be avoiding that suffering to begin with. And so, I think on both ends, if you're being proactive and incorporating risk reduction into day-to-day life, you can alleviate the suffering that actually you see in the aftermath of a disaster. But if you're involved in post-disaster response and recovery, you can also see that you're making a really significant difference. And again, that difference is often made at what can be the lowest point in someone's life.
Professor Gavin Smith from the Coastal Resilience Centre of Excellence in the United States, part of the Department of Homeland Security. Gavin, thank you very much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.